Ante Up is your poker magazine dedicated to the everyday player and their poker rooms. Pick up a free copy at your favorite poker room nationwide each month. But Ante Up is much more than a magazine. Visit anteupmagazine.com daily for breaking news and each week download our award-winning poker cast. Join us on our action-packed poker cruises to exotic destinations and find special deals on Ante Up gear and great poker products at anteupstore.com. Ante Up. It's your poker magazine.
From the WDAE Sports Animal Studios in Tampa, Florida, it's the Ante Up PokerCast. And now here are two guys who think they know how to play poker, Chris Cosenza and Scott Long.
It's November 15th, 2013. You're listening to the best PokerCast there is. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
Hey, you sound different today.
Chris, I've been long.
That's what it is. There's warmth in your heart.
The birds are chirping. The sun is shining. I'm just giddy. You know, I never thought I would feel the kind of love that I feel today. You know, when I was a kid and I snuggled my little blankie that my grandma gave me, I'm like, oh, I'm never going to love anything more than this. And then I went to see Titanic, and I'm like, oh, my God, Kate Winslet, you're so fetching. I'm never going to love anybody more than you. And then I met my wife, and I'm like, wow, you're a real woman, and I'm going to love you for the rest of my life. But no, now I've realized my true love is ante-only tournaments, Chris.
Ante-only tournaments.
I am smitten beyond belief.
You're the smitten kitten.
And I'll tell you more, Toby, later why I'm so smitten with them. But I'm having a lot of fun. I'm out here in California. We're at the Ante Up NorCal Classic, our last Ante Up Poker Tour event of 2013. And that's the place that started it all, Thunder Valley Casino Resort. Absolutely love being out here, man. And at some point, I'm going to have to get you on a plane and get you out here.
Okay? I know.
Enjoy being out here. They take really good care of us, take really good care of the players. And having a great time. The event started, unfortunately, a little slower this year than last year. Kind of some scheduling problems out here. Kind of moved the series up a little earlier rather than starting at the beginning of Thanksgiving, which he's traditionally done. So next year it'll start. Thanksgiving, yeah. We'll get that taken care of.
Yeah.
But it's picked up a lot of steam. Had a huge event last night for their bounty event, and everybody's looking forward to the main event starting today to two day ones today and another day one tomorrow. So if folks are in the Northern California area or can get here quickly, come out and play the main event and get a shot at winning your face on the cover of the magazine.
Absolutely. Sounds cool. So I'm glad that the things are picking up and it sounds like everybody's jazzed for it. So that's cool.
Yeah, I got back. I did a little quick business trip over to Reno last night and got back to the poker room about a couple hours after the night tournament started. And it was so great to get off the parking garage elevator and just hear the poker room.
Yeah.
And seeing a bunch of people there and having a good time. So very excited to see how many people will get for the main event today.
Are you enjoying your pseudo celebrity out there?
Yeah, I am. Of course. Yeah. Absolutely. Why not? And I'm trying to work on the legend, but more on that later. But I want to give a shout out again to our great friend Ben Irwin out here. He's the director of poker operations. I know all our listeners know him because he's been on the show a couple times. And the last time he was on the show, I was sure to mention to him that what I really appreciate about him is how much he listens to players and how quickly he takes those recommendations and turns them in. And I had lunch with him a couple days ago and talked more about it. And again, it's like a kid in a candy store talking to him about, you know, hey, this guy mentioned this to me. I'm like, you know what? I never thought about that. And I'm like, I'll take care of it right away and took care of it. So a couple things that I thought were interesting this time versus last time. Well, this isn't different, but I finally figured it out because, you know, it's funny. I'm on the road like a third of the year, right? And poker rooms all across the country. And still there's things that I hear that I've never really – I'm like, that seems a little odd. I wonder why they're doing it. And they did that here last year, but this year, too, at one of our tournaments, they're like, hey, dealers, you're on a hand shuffle. Don't use the machine. You're on a hand shuffle. And I'm like, I wonder why they're doing that. That's weird. And then it finally occurred to me that because it's a tournament, they've added some temporary tables that don't have the shuffle masters. And they, because of some player feedback, they're like, it's not fair for some of the tables to have machine shufflers and my table to have a hand shuffle because machine shuffles are getting a lot more hands.
That's absolutely correct.
Does that make sense?
Absolutely. It's just so easy, right? That's absolutely right.
And Ben even said, on the multi-day events, he'd been pretty clear in the past of putting everybody at either a machine table or a hand shuffle table, but not necessarily on the second flight. So one flight might be on a hand shuffle, one flight might be on a machine shuffle. And he said some players mentioned to him, hey, you can't even do that. And he's like, you know what? Oh, my gosh. You were so right. And so they fixed that. So that was kind of an interesting thing. It was just one of those things that kind of makes you go, And then now you figure it out. And you're like, oh, it makes perfect sense, right?
Yeah.
I also got a lot of feedback from some players. Our one player in particular, and I don't want to identify him. He's well known, without actually having on the show to tell us his side of it. But he's given Ben a lot of feedback. And one of the things that he told him at the last tournament he was here is that the dealers used to have chips in front of them, higher denomination chips that they could make change with. Uh-huh. And that player said, you know what? Hey, I've got enough. To worry about the table, paying attention to the other nine opponents and what they're doing. I can't also keep my eye on the dealer, and not that your dealers would do this, but it's just possible that you can make incorrect change when you're making change out of the pot, if you're trying to color up or something like that. So that's one thing Ben said immediately. He took all the chips away from the dealers. Now the dealers don't have any chips in front of them, so you don't have that concern, and if they need to make change or something, they make change with players as it should be.
Yeah.
As part of that, interesting, the couple characters I met out here, but one refused to give chip change to the dealer.
I love that.
I mean, he almost begrudgingly gave me change because he was right next to me, and I talked to him, a $500 blue chip and change. He had headphones on and got all flustered and gave me like five blacks, and I'm like, all right. And then literally like three hands later, the dealer tossed him a chip because he had almost like all the blacks on the table, right?
Yeah.
And it, no, I waved her off.
Get back to that shuffle versus automatic shuffle. Do you recall we were at a poker room in Vegas where we wanted to play horse and we were playing and they refused to use that and I walked out?
Right, absolutely.
I was very upset, and that makes more sense.
We were paying a time charge.
Yeah, we're paying a time charge. Now, it makes more sense the reason why we would do it because it costs us more money, but in a poker tournament, I can totally see that. It's totally unfair for someone to get more hands per hour than the other because that's more chances to win more money and more chances to, whatever. So I totally, totally agree with that. I remember that. I walked out. I was like, if you guys aren't going to give us use the shuffler, then I'm going to leave. And they're like, sorry, we can't. I'm like, all right, well, you're going to lose my $6 for half an hour. And we were playing horse, too. So we would have gotten like three hands an hour in. You know what I mean? It was crazy.
God, yeah.
So I just walked out, and then I had a huge night at the Mirage, so I was very happy about that. But, yeah, no, it totally makes sense. So what else is going on out there?
And then the last thing that's really different this year is, and I think Ben might have mentioned it when we had him on the show, but they finally converted to all their dealers working specifically for the poker room. This is kind of these behind-the-scenes things that I don't think a lot of players understand.
Yeah.
But in some rooms, the dealers are shared among all table games.
So you'll get a blackjack dealer or something sometimes.
And not necessarily in the sense that you're going to get a blackjack dealer that circles in through the poker room and a poker dealer circling through the blackjack, but just they're all under the same hierarchy at the casino.
Yeah.
And the bigger thing is that they have to share tokes with those players.
Yeah.
And that's been something that he's been working on for a while, and finally they've separated, so they're completely separate now. And presumably... and I think it's pouring out in this tournament that you end up getting better dealers that way because you're getting poker-specific dealers that really understand the game and care about it. They get to keep their own tokes now, and it becomes a better experience for all the players, I think.
I think the first time you and I encountered that where they shuffled in other dealers from other games and stuff was Mount Airy. We were up there to visit doing a road trip or something, and they're like, yeah, we got blackjack dealers coming in here and sharing tokes with them and blah blah blah. And we're like, whoa, that's kind of weird. So it's definitely out there. But I would prefer totally to have somebody who's always dealing poker, always cares about poker, and always knows poker. So that's good. Good for them.
Yeah, it's one of those spreadsheet things that doesn't make sense to people that aren't you know, or executive that's not a poker player.
Yeah.
You know, it makes sense to have everybody there, but if you actually play, then you clearly see why it's not a good idea. Take some time at some places to get that through, but Ben was able to get it through pretty quickly here. But yeah, I did a bunch of business meetings here, and people say, "Oh, you must play a lot of poker, Scott." And I give them the same song and dance. You know, we quit our jobs to start a poker magazine so we could play a lot less poker. The only time I get to play is when I travel, and I love supporting these events. And obviously, this one I came out a little earlier than I had planned because our listeners know I won the horse event here last year, right?
You did?
I did.
I wouldn't call that a victory.
Last year it actually was, well, sort of.
See, you always got to clarify with the sort of.
So I want to get out here and defend that title. So unfortunately, you know, I still think I'm a He-Man traveler, and I got to remember that I'm 41 years old going on 86.
Yeah.
And took an 8-hour flight with layovers out here on Sunday, and then, of course, went to visit some family, some friends, the Golden Gate Bridge, all that kind of stuff. Made another casino visit. Ended up being a 22-hour day from the time I got up in the morning in Florida to the time I put my head down on my bed here at Thunder Valley Casino Resort. And woke up the next morning and had to go right into the horse tournament. And not the sharpest I've ever played. A little foggy.
Hey, don't be blaming. It's just how you play. Don't be blaming.
No,
you're tired.
No, what I'm blaming is my own belief in my ability to be bright-eyed and bushy-tailed at any moment. When at my advanced age, that is not something that I should be counting on.
Right.
But yeah, so I played the horse event, and I don't think I played poorly. I just I wasn't in the frame of mind to play well. So I went out 21st, I think. This year, so obviously disappointed I couldn't defend the title, but the good thing was is that I got out in time to get into the Limit Omaha 8, the night event, which is one thing that Ben's going to mention next year. He's like, you know, I really thought I was doing the players a favor by putting those two events on the same day, but players really would rather have them on consecutive days, so he didn't feel rushed to get out of one and get into the other, right?
Yeah.
Of course, if you get flame out big time in the horse event, then you don't have to worry about it like I did. But I got in the Omaha, and real quickly, like within the first hour, I could tell I was dragging. I was tired, and I am almost 98% convinced that I misread my opponent's hand and let him have the low, half the pot. Ooh. On a hand where I should have had it. And it's one of those things where I had a live ace, which is always the most confusing thing when you're teaching Omaha to people, is with the live ace or live deuce, and that means. And I played it back. I tried to, you know, wave the dealer off the last minute, but he scooped up all the cards, and I'm like, forget it. It's my problem. And then I just stewed on it for a while, right? And then I'm like, you know what? It's my fault. I should never have gotten in this tournament. I really wanted to play it because the rest of the events are all null and hold them, and I was just forcing myself to play a game that I love to play at a time that it's not optimal for me to play.
Right.
And that's frustrating, I think, isn't it? Oh, I mean, I used to do it online all the time. You know, I get out of a tournament and be like, you know, 2 in the morning, and I'm like, oh, they got a horse tournament starting. I got to get in that. I love horse. And then 4 a.m. when I'm just like seeing unicorns running across the living room, you know, like, what am I doing?
Yeah.
It's just not worth it.
I feel that way a lot of times when we're on the cruise and I want to get a 3-6 hole game going and there isn't one. And then I'm exhausted and I look over and they're like, you want to play 3-6 hole? And I'm like, yes, even though I'm exhausted, but I want it. It's my one chance to play it, or I want to get it going again, or I want to keep it going. I want everybody happy and I want to play. And I'm the same thing. I'm just, when I'm exhausted, you know, you don't want to play, but there are certain times where you're like, I'm not going to get this opportunity again. I'm going to play and take a, you know, get a Red Bull or something.
Yeah. but then I rallied after that and I started hitting a lot of hands, and then I'm like, you know what, I think I can do this. So we were like 20 players left, and we had 80 for this tournament, which is not bad for an Omaha event.
No, that's pretty good, actually.
And so with about 20 left, I had a decent stack. But at that point, and this is a problem, and I want to hear from our listeners on this, because I talked to Ben about it the next day. At that point, I was more than in the top half of the chips. At that point, all right, put 20 players left.
So better than average.
I had enough chips for one hand, because at the level the levels were at that point.
Okay.
In other words, almost everybody was completely short stacked at that
right,
point.
Right.
And this is something that I've noticed in every limit tournament I've played in. Maybe not the Palm Beach Horse event that you went far in, because you went much farther than I did. But at some point in all the limit tournaments I've played, you get to a point where everybody seems to be short stacked. And at that point, it's not necessarily bingo. I like people that say it's bingo at that point. I really don't think it's not. It is at that point, because part of the skill at that point is knowing that you're short stacked and not to commit with hands that you're going to go all the way to the river to that aren't worth going all the way to the river to. But for the most part, it is. And what happened to me is we had an all-in, and a guy that had me out-chipped the chip leader at our table, and I had like an ace four X hand that was, and the ace was suited, and I got in and I flopped two pair aces and fours, so my low was dead if the low got there, but I had two pair and up against one player at that point, and went all the way to the river, and the last two cards were runner queens and counterfeited me because he had ace king.
Oh,
and boom, got knocked out. Had I won that hand, I would have been a massive chip leader at the table, and I would like to think I would go on to lease cash in the event, but had a bad river. So, you know, and that happens, you know. So, you know, I'm not upset other than the fact that I just rallied from my sleepiness to go on a run. But I talked to Ben the next day about it, and I'm like, you know, is there anything that can be done to avoid bingo and limit tournaments? And he said that he had talked to Matt Savage, who he talks to quite often, and in some of his tournaments, they freeze the blind levels when the average chip stack is 30 big blinds.
Hmm.
And that way there's play, so it doesn't keep going up at that point. I mean, the tournament's still going to end fairly quickly at that point, because 30 big blinds isn't great in a limit tournament. But then, so I'm like, you know what? You know, maybe it's just not something that can be fixed. And then as much as Ben cares about his job, and he's like, no, everything can be fixed. I think we can figure out a way to make this better. And I'm like, I don't know what it is. But it sort of made me think that, you know, in no-limit events, you know, you get that possibility of pushing all in. So you get some players, they just get massive chip stacks. But in limit, you don't have that ability, right? So I think the chips are usually spread out a little bit more. But it was very interesting to see that again. And it's just upsetting when it goes that way. But got some sleep. Came down, well rested the next day, and played crappy in the limit hold'em, and went on a tear, and I got a quote-unquote sort of win for it. We're down to, we got to the final table. We had 43 people in this tournament, so it wasn't a huge tournament, but we got down to the final table of 10, and immediately everybody wanted to chop.
Jeez.
10-way chop in a 43-player event. And just not cool. But, you know... So part of the situation here is, you know, we talk about in the show, obviously I'm here representing Andy Up. I'm it's an Andy Up event even, you know.
Yeah.
So I don't want to be the jerk that says we're not chopping. But I don't want to chop. Particularly because I was one of the two chip leaders at the table. But so this is the first time I played in a room, and I absolutely love it. And we're going to talk about a little bit more on the listener spotlight this week. But they use chop cards here. You know, some rooms will use just like, you know, red and black cards, and if you know, you put a face down, everybody has one of each, and you put you know, if you want to agree to the deal, you push the yes card in or the red card, whatever it is, and if you don't want to agree to the deal, you push the no card in or the black card. And they actually use them here, and I like it because it keeps it anonymous. So, you know, if you're feeling pressure from everybody at the table to agree to a deal that you don't want to do, you can do it anonymously. They push the cards in, they shuffle them up. And then the first tournament when we did this, they exposed them one at a time, which I think is the way to do it. The second tournament I was in that we chopped, they just turned them all over at once. And the reason I like the first one is you don't know how many people are saying no at that point.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So you got 10 cards in there, and the third card's a no, then there's no deal. But there could be one or two or three other no's in there. So now there's not so much pressure, because that's kind of happens. It's kind of like a jury or a lynch mob, I think. There's people that want to chop, and then like, no, oh, who's the greedy one? Then they start looking around the table. Yeah, I think it's that guy.
Yeah.
It may not be, you know. But it's very interesting. So we resisted the chop. And then the way they do it is once a chop is denied by someone, it can't be another talk of a chop until a player is eliminated.
Yeah, well, that makes sense.
Yeah, so it doesn't bog down the tournament with like, oh, okay, what about, what if we do this now? So
you know, it would be funny. Is it, okay, we eliminate a guy, we take a poll, and then there's still somebody who wants, doesn't want to chop. So then they eliminate another guy. It gets heads up, and then the guy's like, okay, let's put the cards out there. That, oh, who's the jerk that doesn't want to chop?
Oh, man. Yeah, so it's a really good system, I think. And, of course, the funny thing is about if you wait for somebody to get eliminated, usually the person who's getting eliminated is a short stack, right?
Yeah.
Generally speaking. And those are people that are probably agreeing to the job.
Yeah, exactly.
So it doesn't really change anything at that point. all the people get a little bit more money. So we eventually got down to six-handed, I think, in that tournament. And we ended up agreeing to an equal chop, even though I had the chip lead. But I wanted to get everybody into the 5 o'clock tournament. Everybody wanted to play the 5 o'clock tournament, so I was fine doing it. And by holding off, we all got a couple extra hundred more bucks, and that seems to be worth it at that point. And then I came back the next day, and booyah! Did it again!
And, so you're really good at beating 1 in 7 players.
Exactly. And, you know, that's still skill. I know you're mocking me, but it's still skill.
It is skill. I'm not saying it's not skill. It's just funny that I'm sitting in bed, you know, 11 o'clock at night, and my phone goes, and I look over, and there's a photo of you with holding two cards, and I'm like, oh, my God, he won another one. This is great. And then I get the details that it's a 40-player tournament. You chop it 7 ways. I'm like, that's not a win. What is that? Now, you're doing well to make the final table, but you're a player to sit and go.
Yeah, I know. But hey, it all counts, right?
That's right, it counts, and you're making money. Now, the question is, why do you keep showing pocket nines?
Well, just because of the our nines, and I specifically asked to do 2 9s of spades or 2 9s of clubs, like we did last year.
Right.
And they have a specific policy here where they can't do it, which is a great policy to have.
Yes, it is. Are they going to call that the ante up rule? I think is what they're going to call that.
But, you know, I'd like to win one where we could play it out. I really did. So on the first tournament that we chopped, you know, I was quiet during the discussions. I try to stay out of chop discussions in general because it's up to me. I'm almost never going to chop. But I don't want to be the jerk either. But then eventually, as we lost people, we started talking about it more. Eventually, I was like, at that point, in the first tournament, I had a massive chip lead at that point. When we ended up doing the chop, but the chop started talking. And I'm like, you know what, guys? I'm not greedy, and I'm really not. I really just wanted to play it out. I mean, I entered a tournament to play poker, and I want to play it out. And as soon as I said that, it was amazing to me. Everybody at the table was like, I absolutely can respect that. Let's keep playing. Rather than the, oh, you're greedy kind of thing. So that was kind of nice, I thought. But then interesting in that discussion is once we get back to that, somebody's like, all right, can we do a bubble save? And I'm like, sure, I'm going to do a bubble save. You know, I'm not greedy. We're still playing out. And the bubble save discussion immediately morphed into an equal chop. We ended up doing it. But so the second day was an ante-only tournament. We ended up chopping that 6 ways at the end again. But in that one, at that point, we are all probably even at chips, and it was getting close to bingo at that point. So that one was a chop that I was on board with. But I got to tell you, Chris, I love this ante-only format. I've never played it before. I don't know if you have.
No, I have not. I have not.
And it is just, it is really exciting. And now I'm looking forward to my next ante-only event. And I tell you, I've been thinking for a while about getting back into a World Series event, you know, because it's been years since you and I played in one.
Right.
And, you know, I always thought it was going to be like an Omaha 8 or something like that. But I'm thinking maybe I might take a shot at that ante-only next year just because it's so fun. And I don't think people really understand how to play it. So the concept for people, they can't, I'm sure everybody can figure it out, but there's no blind. And the antes increase each level. And everybody antes every single hand, so you would have an absolute coronary.
Yes.
Playing this.
Yes.
And then action does always start left of the button. There's no blinds, obviously, but action starts left of the button like it should. And the minimum bet would be whatever the ante is. So if the ante is $25, then you can bet $25, or obviously it's no limits. You can bet as much as you'd like. And it's a very interesting lot of strategy involved in it that's a little different, I think.
So if you're playing 10-handed and the ante's 25, you're committing 250 every round rather than 75, because it'd be 25-50, right?
Absolutely. Yep.
And then so now you're committing more money every round, so every hand is more valuable because now there's 250 in the middle. First of all, people won't know how much to bet when they raise because there's so much in the middle. Instead of 75 being in the pot, they shouldn't be raising to 75 because it's not three times a blind anymore. Now it's, yep, hey, what's in the pot? Let's think about how much to bet relative to the pot. So
exactly, yeah.
Yeah, so you really have to adjust. I would open up my hand ranges big time, I think, if I was playing.
Well, and that, well, it was very interesting to me, and because I was thinking about it the night before, how I would play it. And I'm like, how does this game change from the normal thing, and what should my strategy be? And then I Googled some strategy, and I was very, I don't want to say happy, that's the wrong word, but I felt a little pride that the strategy I was reading from pros that have played these was very close to what I figured out in my own mind. I mean, obviously, I learned something more from the strategy. People have played a ton of more of these than I have, but I was pretty close on the strategy that I came up in my own mind, and I think that's kind of cool that after however many years in poker that I'm actually being able to figure stuff out on my own without somebody telling me.
Yeah.
And a big thing is that obviously it's a tournament geared to aggression, which I'm normally not, but I can be aggressive when I'm forced to. I really wanted to play the six-handed a couple of days ago, but that was the day that we chopped the tournament, and I was just tired at that point, so I didn't. And the reason I want to play the six-handed is it forces me to be aggressive, and that's my biggest problem. And the ante definitely forces you to be aggressive because you're right. You're putting in 250 instead of 75 every round.
Yep.
And there's a lot more to win in the pot. But the other thing, too, is that, and I saw this play out, it was amazing, is that you have tremendous odds every hand.
Yeah.
I mean, think about it. You got 250 already in the pot, and you only have to put in 25. That's 10 to 1 on your money.
Yeah.
And, I mean, obviously, you don't want to do this all the time, but, you know, some of the strategy I was reading is, you know, you almost got odds with any two cards to be in if it's not a raised pot.
Sure.
Particularly if you're late in position and there's a bunch of limpers in. So now you've got 15, 17 on your money. Maybe even 20 if everybody limped in.
Yep.
So you got to play every two cards. And like we always say on the hand of the week, though, if you're going to come in with garbage cards, then you need to hit hard. You know, you're not going to wait for top pair with your seven tray and try to take down the pot. But so what was really funny about this tournament for me is that the couple tournaments I already played, I don't think the play was very strong. Now, these are $125, $150 tournaments, so they're consistent with a play that I've seen at that level anywhere I travel, so I'm not picking on the players here necessarily. It's just a $125 tournament, right? And players weren't as strong as other players that I played. So I'm like, oh my gosh, if I get those same players in the ante-only tournament, they're not going to know how to play the ante-only, and I think I am, and I'm going to have even a bigger edge. Sit down at the table, and like every pro, every player I looked around, every player knew exactly how to play. I'm like, where were you guys all week? But then as I played, I realized that those players were really good, and but they didn't adjust to the ante-only structure. People were folding way too much. I played almost every single hand, unless there was a raise in front of me.
Right.
You know, hey, I'll throw another quarter in, 500, 600, whatever it is at the ante at that point, and you win a ton of hands that way. There were two hands I won simply by limping in.
Let me ask you, was the raising amount twice the pot when people raised? Were they raising, if it was 250 in the pot already, were they raising like to 500, or were they raising to like 200 or something, two-thirds the pot?
It depended. When people were raising, they usually were betting about half the pot, which is, I think, a strategy.
Okay.
So, like, you know, at the 25 level, you know, people were putting like 125, 150 in when they were raising. So that was interesting.
Because when you think about it, if the blinds were 25-50, you'd be making it 150, which is twice what's in the pot already. You'd make it 3x, which is 3 times 50, which is 150. If there's 75 in the pot already, you're literally betting twice of what's in the pot already, essentially. So now with the antes, it's 250. Would you bet 500, or would you? Because now relative to your stack, it's a lot more to bet 500 than it is to bet 75. So now you're starting to think, if you bet 150 or 100, you're giving every. Let's say you bet, I don't know, it's 250 in the middle. So let's say you bet 150. Well, now they're only have to bet 150 to win 400. If one person does that, now everybody at the table essentially has odds to call. So you, I can imagine some pretty big pots too.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And then what's really interesting is that when people limp in, and this is kind of one of the cool things about the format, is that when people are limping in, it's almost like playing heads up poker. You know, when you're playing heads up with someone, almost nobody has a hand. You know,
right, yeah.
You might have a high card, but you're not going to pair right. I saw that a lot in this too, because now you got to figure out, oh my God, did this person limp in with seven tray and just hit the two sevens? Or is he making, or is he just have queen something and is trying to represent? And that was a lot of fun. I was on the beneficial end of that a lot, where I had people really trying to figure out what I had and eventually folded. And I took down a lot of pots with nothing because of that. And when they called, I always ended up with the goods. It really stressed people out at that point. And at that point, and it's not just me or the other players, but other players started thinking about that in terms of the other players. You really don't know where you are at any point.
Yeah, it's weird.
And so it's a game of chicken, really, at that point. So yeah, it was a lot of limping in, and occasionally, and you know, I never really. It wasn't to the final table that I put more in on when I entered a pot than the minimum. The entire tournament, I just put the minimum in, even when I had kings and aces. And, you know, you're hoping when you do that that somebody's going to raise behind you, then you can re-raise. Or you just get lucky with the flop. And the one time I had pocket kings and did that, had like seven people in, and the flop came three of my suit, one of my suits. Bet and took it down without even having to show the kings. But yeah, it's just it's such a fascinating structure, and it really changes your poker mindset on how to play.
It sounds like it's right up my alley, even though I don't appreciate the whole, unless people, you know, if they're entering an ante tournament, I think they're pretty aware that they have to ante all the time, so I wouldn't be that frustrated.
Right, yeah.
And I love to speculate. The, when I play poker the best is when I win a couple of pots early and I've got a much bigger stack than I started with, and I like to speculate with cards, and then I'm hitting hands that they never put me on and that kind of thing. And so I think I would like an ante-only structure. I don't know. I could flame out and hate it, but I mean, it sounds like it's something I would enjoy.
It was crazy at the final table. The guy that was a chip leader by a large amount until we finally made a deal and I had passed him at that point, he was folding almost every single hand. Now, in a lot of tournaments, when you have a big chip lead like that, sure, you might as well, you know, why be the table captain and, you know, double somebody up, you know, unless you got the goods. But in this tournament, you know, that bring-in wasn't going to cost him anything, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if he hits a hand, all he has to do is hit one hand, and he can call any of the short stacks and with a lot more confidence than he would hitting it all in pre-flop, right?
Yeah.
And it was just amazing to me. I would just watch every time he folded. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, great. And that's how I got – that's how I took the chip lead. It wasn't that I really doubled or took anybody out. I was just picking up a ton of annies.
Scott,
so I live in. There might be two of us in because everybody's kind of short stacks. So they either wanted to shove or fold. And I'm in there with one other guy. It's a different guy every time. And I'd make a bet and take it down and move. Now I got annies. And you do that three or four times around – you chip up a ton really quickly.
Scott Long, he watches other fold his way to victory.
Love it.
He's got the goods. You need your own sitcom, buddy. Or at least your own reality show. That's what you need. Well, I'm glad you're having a good time. I'm glad you're sort of winning. And hope some more good news comes out of it, and we'll see what happens next week. But we're already halfway through our show, and we haven't gotten to the listener spotlight yet. So let's do that. We mentioned it earlier. So each week we spotlight a listener who called our hotline at 813-448-1120. By the way, not a lot of people calling it these days. Get on the phone. Or who emailed us at podcast@antiupmagazine.com. And if they haven't won something from us in the past year, just like we do with Call the Floor and Hand of the Week, We'll send them something fantastic. This week's sponsor, J-Design Playing Cards, is the official playing cards of Annie Up. Check out J-Design's great cards and more at classicplayingcards.com. This comes from Jimmy Fulton, and it's about shopping. He says, I recently decided to get back into poker with a goal set in mind. I've set aside $1,000 to use to play with. I'm going to build it up as much as possible and buy into a tournament at the World Series next year. I started 2 weeks ago, and I have managed to run it up to a little over $2,000. Man, who needs the World Series when you double your stake?
Forget it, stay home.
Most of it coming from chopped prize pool of a $100 tournament last night. I have always been against chopping. Part of the enjoyment for me has always been to win the tournament. Sounds like Scott Long wrote this.
Amen, brother.
But now that I am trying to turn a $1,000 investment into a World Series seat, I let the people at the table talk me into chopping. Even though I wanted to play out the tournament, they offered me $1,000, which was $200 lower than second place, so I went ahead and took it. I was curious as to what you guys think of chopping. What would be your reasons for chopping or not chopping? And do you guys think chopping takes away from tournament poker? The rest of the people at the table were concerned with the blinds being so high. We had roughly 10 big blinds in front of us, with the exception of the chip leader, who probably had 20 or 30 big blinds. A couple things I want to say real quick before you chime in.
Sure.
If you have $1,000, what exactly, what seat is he looking for at the World Series? I'm trying to figure out. I mean, there are tournaments out there that you could play for $1,000 already.
Well, maybe he doesn't want to blow his entire bankroll on tournaments.
Oh, I know. That's what I'm saying, though, but it sounds like he did. It sounds like he was building it up to spend it on a seat. So I was curious if that
maybe he's building it up so he could take a shot at it and still have money to come home.
So travel money and all that. Okay, so that's one. And then the other thing is, wow, I realize you did it mostly in a tournament, obviously, but what I really like is that Jimmy wins at night and the next morning is emailing us for advice about it. So that's cool. His first thought is, I got to talk to Annie Up after I win all this money. So let me tell you how to invest that money, Jimmy. We have a fund. It's the Scott Chris Fund. And no, really, I'm just kidding. Here's my thing about chopping. I love to chop. Why? Because generally I'm not going to see the hour or 2 hour long blinds like I did at the World Series when I made that cash. And when it does get down to 10 blinds, I am confident, like when I'm playing horse, I'm confident that maybe I'm probably better at most of the games than 8 or 7 of the people at the table or something like that. Better than half, I would think.
Sure.
So yeah. I would think that I have an advantage to keep playing if there's enough structure. But when you're playing like no limit hold'em and you have 10 big blinds and everyone has 10 big blinds except one guy, you literally are... I mean, yeah, there's some strategy to know when to push, but really, you're not outplaying people at that point. Even if you're better than them, it's not going to matter. What advantage do you have? Now, in Scott's case, when he was a big chip leader, he's flown across country, he doesn't get to play that often, he'd like to finally finish off one of these things instead of chopping and calling himself a victory, you know, or a title holder. You know, I can see wanting to play it out. But to me, the more you chop, the more goodwill you spread, the more money stays within the community, the more willing they'll be to play another tournament. There's just a lot of good things that come from a chop if you're benevolent. If you're, hey, I'm here to make money, and this is all I want to do, and I'll check raise my grandmother who's on a respirator, well, then okay, that's fine. But then again, you might not get those 9 rubes in a game again with you later because those guys, it was a once in a... every 10 or 20 tournaments that they're going to even cash, never mind make a final table. And so you might not get that money back. And yeah, you're going to have all the money, but then when you go out there, it's not going to be any money to win again. So obviously I'm not saying that all of the fields of poker tournaments around the world are going to shrivel up if we all don't chop, but I'm one for chopping when it's an escalated, you know, time blind structure and we don't have a lot of money. Now, if I got to go back to that World Series, and we had 13 players left. I was very comfortable with the stack that I had playing a limit, you know, game, which was all of them were limit, and I was very comfortable playing to the end and seeing if I won or not. I was not going to chop a World Series ring, so
right.
I would have played that to the end. But overall, especially no limit hold'em, I don't think chopping is bad for tournament poker. I think... That's exactly what it is. It's tournament poker, and you're going to keep the money in the community and live to... You know, that's the other thing, too, is you don't want to leave it to variation. You want to be able to outplay. That's why you're playing, because you're confident that you're better than the people you're playing against, and you can win money from them. But when nets get taken away from you, then why take the chance? Because now you're putting them on equal footing with you with coin flips, and I would rather just take the money now and not take that variance, you know, and take it out of play. So that's my stake. I know you've got a whole other way of going with it, so go ahead.
Here's the thing, is that we could talk for hours about chopping. I mean, really would, to be to completely answer this question, we would be talking hours, and we've already talked close to an hour already, so we won't get into nitty-gritty. So I'm going to speak in generalities, and that's my warning to all the listeners out there not to flame me with, like, oh my gosh, because there are subtleties that we're not going to get into here.
You'd be surprised how many of our listeners actually sound like that, too.
Oh my gosh.
So I'm going to take those questions. Do you guys think chopping takes away from tournament poker? I do, actually. That's why I said it at the beginning of the show. I enter a tournament to play to win. And I want to play not just to win, but I also like the skill you get from playing five-handed, four-handed, three-handed, and the heads up, which no one ever gets, because all of these tournaments always end up chopping. And you don't get those skills, and eventually you're going to find yourself in a tournament where somebody else doesn't want to chop, and you're not going to have the experience that they have playing that way. So, I know a lot of people enter a tournament just to hope to win money. I hope to win the most money. So it does bother me when we get into these chop discussions, generally speaking. Now, the tournament you're mentioning, the 10 big blinds, at that point, that's when it crosses into bingo for me at that point.
Yeah.
And as you mentioned, there is some subtle strategy there that I think a lot of people miss, that I don't think I do in that situation. So there's a little bit of an edge, but it's not enough of an edge to overcome it at that point. So if it's 10 big blinds at that point, then it's just ridiculous at that point. And it's not worth gambling, because even if you're the best player at the table and you're the one with the 20 and 30 big blinds, you very well could be the first one out at that point.
Yep.
So that would be my consideration. If I got enough play at the table, then I don't see any reason in my mind really never to chop, unless I've got a real short stack and I'm on fumes and I know I'm going to lock up a profit in this tournament, whereas I'm going to have to gamble at that point. So I think overall that's what it comes down to. If you feel like you're gambling, then you absolutely want to chop. If you don't feel like you're gambling, then you shouldn't, because you're giving up too much value. I mean, we'll use the example, I think one of the tournaments, it was 1,300 on top, and we ended up taking 600 or so each on the first tournament, I think. It was a 125-hour buy-in. So we all made about five times our money,
yeah,
which is not bad. And it was right around second-place money, a little bit below. Actually, a little bit below, maybe a little bit more than third-place money, which is not bad for seven. So, I mean, you moved up four spots on the prize pool by doing it. But it was 1,300 on top. Mm-hmm. So I just gave up $700 in value in that tournament that you could be playing for. And if you think about you end in the next tournament, you got to wade through the entire field to get back to that opportunity to win $700. Here, you're at a final table with seven people, and you're giving up that value. So that's why if I don't feel like I'm gambling, I never want to chop at that point. And I'm clear, like I was with the people. I'm like, you know, I'm not greedy. I could be the first one, because that's what everybody's going to say when you don't want to chop. Wow, person who's want to chop is always the first one out. They don't get anything. And I've been in tournaments where the people that's happened, and those people get up to walk away with nothing, and they gave up $400, $500, $600. And I am fine if I'm that guy, because that's just the way it goes. I'm taking a chance at that point for a $1,300 prize payday versus a $400. But you have to be ready to accept that. But you know, as you mentioned, there's goodwill involved, and you know, so I mean, there's lots of things that go into the calculation. But I would think, and generally speaking, I want to play it out.
And the other thing too is, you mentioned the schedule is a good idea too. You know, hey, there's a tournament in 10 minutes. Let's all go in that right. tournament and, you know, end it here. One other thing I'll add, maybe just a final point, if you want. If you're like Scott and you show up at that tournament to win the most money, then what you can do is say, I'll agree to a chop, but let's take X out of it and put it on top, and we still keep playing, and the person who wins the whole thing gets that bonus money. So then you can say, I won the most money, which you did, and then you're also playing for something, so they'll continue to play seriously. And then if you lose, it's not that big of a deal.
Yeah. Actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because real quickly, that was part of the consideration in the first CHOP discussion. You know, because we started a 10-handed. We didn't want to do it, or someone, wink, wink, didn't want to do it. So when we got down to the seven-handed, at that point, I had tripled up and was massive chip leader. And I told him at that point, I'm like, guys, look at my chip stack. Would you do an even chip chop at this point? And they're like, no, you're right. So what more can we give you to do a chop here? And I think I fumbled this. So I'm curious what you would say. But at that point, I kind of stuck to my guns, and I'm like, you know what? I'm not greedy. I'm not trying to get more out of you guys. I just want to play poker. And that's, you know, when I got, you know, everybody's like, all right, I get it. But at that point, I later thought about this, that it was a missed opportunity for me, because everybody at that table, as far as I could tell, except maybe one, because again, the chop cards is hard to tell, everybody was comfortable chopping 10-handed for $400 at X, right?
Mm-hmm.
At that point, what I should have done is just give me two shares, because that would have been everybody still would have gotten more money than they were agreeing to earlier, right?
Right.
And I would have got what I thought was fair enough for me. That would have been more than second place money for me. And I'm curious whether people would have taken that deal, or whether they would have saw it as greed.
Well, I don't think it's greed. And what I'm basing it on is, and Gambit will back me up, Gambit has the formula for doing the independent chip model or whatever, where chip stack equity will tell you how much you deserve. So you could literally break that out and say, this is how much I deserve, guys, and I'm taking less. So let's just give me two shares. You guys take your six shares and divide it up how you want, but give me two shares, because I am the chip leader, and if we froze the tournament right here, I'd be making X, and I'm only asking for half X. So, you know, I don't think that's greed. I think you've earned it. You've deserved to make what you want. I wouldn't want to do an even chop. And a lot of times when I say chop, I don't mean even chops. I mean, it happened when I won that Raz tournament at the International Series. You know, it was a chop, and we chopped it. But I was confident that if we kept playing, I could have won or whatever. But we evenly chopped it because it was roughly the same stacks with everyone. But yeah, no, absolutely. You can literally bring that formula, pop it out, and say, all right, let's do the chip model here, where we do chip stack equity, and you'll see that I deserve X amount of money in this prize pool. And I think the floor people have that, or they would know about it, and they would do it if you wanted to. So that's when people bring up the chopping, say, if you want to win more money than anybody else, and you deserve it because you're the chip leader, and it's an overwhelming chip leader, you have to say, all right, well, I need to get X, or I need to get this formula calculated so you can see how much I deserve. And I'll take a little less off because I'm not greedy. That way you don't come off as greedy. You're actually acquiescing and giving more money back. That's a good way of doing it, I think. That formula
actually came up in the very first CHOP discussion. The other woman at her table, who I think probably voted against the CHOP as well, just trying to cover my tracks here. she suggested, hey, let's do it based on chip stack. And the reaction from the other players was, well, I think it's only going to be a difference of $40 here or there. And they didn't think it was worth the misery of counting down the chips for that. That was an interesting reaction that I didn't expect. I assumed at that point people were like, oh, all right, fine, whatever.
No, at that point, if they really believe that, then you break out the formula and say, there's no way it's $40 difference for me, you know, or whatever. I got way more chips in this than you do. I've got more value, more equity.
Well, yeah, but I mean, the short stacks, they want to got less than they bought in for. And at that point, I think it destroys the deal at that point. No one's going to cash for, you know.
Yeah, common sense rules, too. Yeah, common sense. If you know that they're going to lose money on a deal, you're not going to demand something. So if you're willing to take a chop, you know, and you think you need to make more money, then either play out for it or do the chip equity stack thing and sort of acquiesce a little at the end. All right, we got a new O'Malley's move. Let's get to it.
Hello, and welcome to another O'Malley's Move. I'm Malcolm O'Malley. This week, we're seated at a $1-$2 PLO 8 game. The action's been pretty standard for this type of game, pretty passive pre-flop, but then lots of betting and raising after the flop. We scooped a massive pot against four opponents about an hour ago, and we sit with about $800. We're up six big bills. The under-the-gun limps, plus one folds, plus two folds, the MP calls, MP1 calls, hijack calls, and we're in the cutoff with the ace of clubs, king of hearts, king of clubs, seven of diamonds. While we do have the potential to get a low, it would be a very mediocre low. However, with so many callers, there is a good chance that there are already a lot of low cards out there. We're going to raise it up here, even though we only have a one-way hand. We make it $25 to go. The button calls, the small blind folds, the big blind calls, and it's folded around. We hate being out of position. With about $80 in the pot, the flop comes down, the king of spades, queen of clubs, seven of hearts. This is a pretty decent flop for our hand. The big blind checks, and we make it $50 to go. After thinking for a while, the button tosses in a call. The big blind folds. The button is a maniac, but not in the true sense of the word. There is method to his madness. He's got a good grip on the game, and obviously knows what's going on. Perhaps he only gives the appearance of being a maniac. He's up 300, and started the hand with 5. The turn is the 4 of spades. With 180 in the pot, we elect to employ some pot control. We slow down and check. Our opponent thinks only for a short while before counting out a clean 100 and puts it into the pot. Once again, we don't want to make this pot too big, but we do have the nuts right now. A raise here might get a re-raise, and we really don't want to get it all in with a hand that can only improve so much, especially with such a drawy board. We could be up against a multi-draw hand. We call. There's 380 in the pot, and the river is the jack of hearts. We once again check for pot control, and our opponent shoves for his remaining 325. Ugh. What's the play here?
It's time for Hand of the Week. Send your hands or situations to podcast@antiummagazine.com. This week's sponsor is Smapsoft, creator of the Chinese 13-card poker app for Apple products. Download the app today by visiting the iTunes store. And this week's hand comes all the way from New Zealand. Always love those hands. Alex Pooler. Alex Pooler is playing in the pub leagues over there. They got a lot of pub leagues over in New Zealand.
Yep.
I added an R to his name. He actually even gave me a pronunciation guide. It's Alex Poole.
Alex Poole, okay.
Look at that, I screwed it up already. he says he's been listening to our show every week for about a year and re-listening to old shows repeatedly. And so here's the hand that he's going to throw at us. He's like, I was playing at my local pub game. It's a free buy-in with $10 rebuys for the first four levels and a $10 add-on. You begin with 3,000 chips at 2550 with the blinds increasing every 20 minutes. We were on the final table, and I had 44,000, and the blinds were 501,000. So 44 big blinds. He's doing well.
He's doing okay.
A fairly weak player with squiggly 28,000 raised under the gun to 2,000. So min raise.
Min raise, yeah.
Action folded to me, and I looked down at 10 of diamonds, 8 of diamonds on the button.
I'll take a flyer. I mean, normally, but I'm in position. Obviously, I'm doing well in this tournament, so I'm out playing a lot of these players, so being in position and in that situation is always a good idea. So I'll take a flyer and call him. I'm not going to re-raise. I might re-raise if I think this guy... When you say he's fairly weak, too, I don't know what that really means. Is it weak because he doesn't understand the game, or is he so weak that the only time he raises is when he has a big hand? So I don't really know what that means, but I might just call then in that situation.
Sure, yeah. I guess that's what I was going to say. This is a hand that I like to raise with, but I got to know the player I'm going to do it. I mean, more than likely, I'll probably just call here and have a hand that I know can really bust someone. Part of my consideration calling here is he's got 28,000, so I would say fairly close, but I'm going to guess that he's probably second or third in chips.
Okay.
Yeah. Or first, I could be wrong, but yeah. And I don't want to gamble with a player with that many chips. I'd rather gamble with a player with a lot less chips. So, I mean, I'm going to wait for my stronger hands to play. against us at this point.
All right, so we have 8-10 of diamonds. I'm thinking of calling. What's he do?
All right, he says, I have been watching this guy for about 2 hours and noticed that he would raise any two he got married to any pocket pair, betting and calling the whole way down with deuce-deuce to 6-6 several times. Tended to bet with any hand on all three streets, regardless of the action, and players in the hand, and regardless of the action, players in the hand or board texture. He also tended to bet small with smaller pocket pairs and larger with a king jack suited or ace queen offsuit kind of hand, like ace ace jack jack. Okay, so that makes sense to me. Apparently, the player he's scared of his. He's too scared to raise with the hands that he needs to raise with, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's common. You get 4-4 under the gun. It's a hand you don't want to throw away, even though you probably should. So you feel like you need to raise, but you don't want to commit a lot. So you do the min raise, right?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting that, I mean, I understand you're playing with this guy for 2 hours, but to say that amount of details he gave us on this one player is remarkable. I mean, I don't even get that much information on Scott. I've been playing with him for 8 years. So
because I keep changing my game.
Yeah, that's pretty remarkable to this guy show down that many hands and to raise that many hands where you've seen king-jack suitor, ace-queen offsuitor, whatever. I mean, that many hands for 2 hours, that's pretty incredible. So that's a lot of detail to me. I feel like Alex is setting us up here. I feel like he's going back and doing revisionist history here, but I'm not going to accuse him of that. I just feel like that. But that's a lot of detail to get from one player after 2 hours. But if it's true, then we got to feel like this guy's got pocket fives or something, you know, or sixes, because that's so far the MO. So, but anyway, I don't really care. I just want to know what he does.
It seems like it. So, I mean, if that's the case, then I'm almost more emboldened to raise here, because it's probably going to make him check on the flop, and then I'll be able to take it down with a continuation bet at that point, because he's going to think we have a stronger hand. And, you know, unless we get unlucky in the flop, you know, he flops a set. Again, I mean, obviously it's a very specific narrow range that we shouldn't be going that narrow on, but if that's the case, then I think we can take this down with a raise here and a second bet.
Yeah, I agree with that.
And that'd be fine. So
we always instruct people about that, too. Always raise the same amount no matter what you have, because people will pick up on when you have crap and you raise min, then they know you have crap. So if that's what's going on here, then I would, if I'm putting them on two unders to my 10-8 of diamonds, I might raise and c-bet. So, you know, I made that, I'd say I would take a flyer on it before, but not realizing he's going to give me this incredible opus of this guy's life. So now that I know what he might actually raise with, min raise with, I might actually raise with 10-8 of diamonds as well. But then what do you make it? I guess you'd make it $6,000, I guess.
Yeah. At the same point, though, that's the thing. If I thought the blinds were not going to come in, which is tough to say, but maybe he had a read on them as well, too, a bet on the flop is going to get the same result, right? So
yeah.
we can commit less here and just call his min raise and make that bet on the flop and not have to commit more in case we're wrong. So I guess that would be the argument for just calling here. But I wouldn't want to. Well, I mean, I guess I wouldn't mind the other people coming in with 10. We have 10-8 of diamonds. We got a hand that really could hurt some people.
Yeah, and you're getting the odds then. If they just call, now you get. See, you got $8,000 in the middle. Now you have suited one gapper in position, which is exactly what you want.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I wouldn't mind it. A call is not a bad idea. And a
raise, you know what? Yeah,
is not a bad
idea. I'm talking myself into a call here easily.
Okay. See, it's weird because I talked myself into a raise. So that's bizarre. But no, I mean, I would consider still just calling because of the blinds behind us and the fact that we do have 10-8. But if you could really narrow this guy down to 4-4, 5-5, something like that, 6-6, 7-7, I might consider raising just so I can get heads up with him and steal it from him with really a crappy hand.
Yeah, and the call is less than, 5% of our stack, so.
Yeah. We got $44,000.
Yeah. All right, so he says, with this in mind, I called, hoping to bring the big blind in and flop two pair or better. Small and big blinds folded, though, and we went heads up to the flop.
Okay.
Doesn't change much for me. That's what we initially thought, is to get them out, and then I thought I kind of wanted them in, but I'm not opposed to them being out, so it's easier for us to win, though. The flop is the king of diamonds, king of clubs, 10 of spades, and the villain C bets for 10K. I'm sorry, 2K. 2K. Same bet.
Okay, so here's the deal. I think we're way ahead. Because also in that description, he said something about he bet more with larger hands. So if he had a hand bigger than 10s, jack-jack, queen-queen, ace-king, aces, he would have bet more pre-flop, and he would have bet more after that flop. So I think we're way ahead now.
Mm-hmm.
And I might just call one street just to see, you know, leave him alone. Because he says he tends to bet every street no matter what. So if I raise him, he might fold, and I'm not going to get that money out of him. So I'm going to call here. I think we're way ahead, and I'm going to let him. Yeah. I'm going to walk the dog, I think.
I don't think anything good comes from raising here, to be honest.
Yeah.
Because I'm with you. I think we have the best hand here. I think by the description we're getting, this guy's going to continue to bet. If we raise here, we could scare him away and not get any value out of him.
Yep.
Or if we're wrong on a reading, he has a king, then it's going to really kill us, right?
Yeah.
So I don't think anything good comes from raising. I'm just going to call here. I'm going to do the Hollywood a little bit and think about it and put the call in. And then hope that he fires on the last two streets. And you know, if he keeps firing, he keeps it low like this, 2K, even if we're wrong, you know, we're not going to be hurt at all. And if we really decide by the end of the hand that we're convinced that we really are ahead, then we can put in a raise and get more value out of him.
And this is when position is so beautiful, because he's just going to keep betting into you. He's going to dictate the amount. You can decide if it's worth the call or not. You can decide if you need to raise. It's just so beautiful to be in position here and to be confident of your read and that you're ahead. So, yeah, let's just call and see what happens.
All right. So, that's. So he says, yeah, connect to a second pair, backdoor flush draw, and decide to call to evaluate the next street.
Yeah, it makes sense. Yeah, it makes sense.
The turn is the deuce of diamonds. So our board now is king of diamonds, king of clubs, ten of spades, deuce of diamonds. And now we pick up the flush draw.
Sweet.
And the villain, again, bets 2K, which is exactly what I thought. You know, and I'm going to pause here real quick to say, one of the things I noticed in my tournaments this week is I am finally realizing that I'm predicting action fairly quickly. Mostly when I'm not in the hand, and I need to work on being in the hand. But there are hands I'm watching, and I'm like, by the way it was going down, I'm like, all right, that guy's going to check the flop. That guy's going to bet. The guy that checks is going to call, and then he's going to bet on the turn, and the guy's going to fold. And it happened, like, every single time.
Yeah.
And that's really – it felt like really powerful at that point when you start figuring that out.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, on this one, I mean, my experience with fairly weak players is they're going to continue to put the same bet. So I wouldn't be surprised if we just call here if the villain's going to bet 2K again on the river.
Yeah.
Fortunate at it. All right, so anyhow, though, so he bets 2K. The pot's 9,500, and it's on us now. We're going to keep stringing them along, or are we going to spring a trap now?
You know, I got no reason to raise yet. I know he's going to put another $2,000 in again on the river, and if I make my flush, then I can raise, and if I don't, I can just call and be happy with the pot. I don't see any reason to raise, because if I raise and he has absolutely nothing, or if he's scared, he might fold, and then I lose that $2,000 that I can get on the river that he's probably going to bet. If I raise and he re-raises, now I'm put to a test. Uh-oh, he was just stringing me along, hoping to get the minimum until I would do something crazy, and now he's got three kings, and I was totally off on my read. So I'm going to call again and hope another diamond comes, and of course hope it's not something that gives him a boat if he does have a small pair or a king in his hand that now pairs his other card or whatever. So I don't mind just calling again. I know if it was limit hold'em, I would probably raise, but it's not. No sense in getting it down that river. But I'm just going to call one more time.
I am as sure of a move as I've ever been in Hand of the Week history here. I am raising the 4K here.
Oh, it's a 4K?
Throwing a little min raise in, and here's why. I don't think he's going to fold for the extra 2K. So I'll pick it up an extra street of value, maybe. You know, obviously, at least I'm getting the opportunity to pick up an extra street of value, because maybe if he calls, he decides to check behind on a river, and I kind of put a bet in and maybe fold. But it's still the same 2K I'm going to get out of him on the river if I just call here, right? And I get the opportunity for him to maybe bet some more or maybe call my bet on the river. So I'm going to squeeze an extra 2K out of him, I'm thinking. If he raises, now we've picked up some outs now, and now we got the diamonds to fall back on. Which you said, you know, which are right, might not be right if we're way off on our read here. If he's already got a boat or has a king and he's got a potential to get a boat, then it may not be good. But it's going to make me feel a little more secure than I was on the flop. I really think this is a chance for us to squeeze an extra 2K of value out of this guy, and maybe more. And then if the flush does come, maybe he's not going to put us on a flush draw raising here, right? A fairly weak player, I don't think, would do that. So the flush comes, he might actually decide to get crazy and bet out thinking that he's killed us and we can raise him.
Yeah.
Whereas if you wait for the flush to come, this guy's not going to call us on the river. I mean, we'll put that bet out as we should, but I really don't think he's going to call on the river. So.
here's my thinking. You were talking about if you min raised on the turn, you think he's gonna not fold for that. So okay, let's say he doesn't fold for that.
Right.
Now on the river he's not betting out. Now he checks, you bet again, now he may fold. He may not. Now if he
well, that's
does,
what I'm saying, though. It's the same amount of money though.
Right, but it's the same amount of money the other way too. What if it was
right,
you just
but we
call
have the
his
option
turn
of getting more money out of him this way.
Well, if you call the turn
the same thing, but
and then raise the river, you get the same money too. He's not going to fold for just $2,000 more, no matter what happens on the river. So you're still – why would he fold for $2,000 more when you raise him on the river?
Well, but he might fold
turn
on the river because there's not another card to come. Remember, with every card left to come, there's more opportunity for someone to – even if it's the astronomical odds out there, they only have a one outer to catch you. If they know they have another card to come, they have that chance to catch you. On the river, they have nothing else. At that point, they have to look at their hand and say, all right, I got this guy beat. It's a very thin line. I'm not saying it's
well.
A
no,
slam,
I just don't think the reason why he would call your min raise is because there's another card to come. I think he would call it because it's a min raise and it's only $2,000 to him. I don't think he would call because there's a card to come.
What we're saying is more likely that he's going to call it on a min raise on the turn than a min raise on the river is what I'm saying.
I think he's just calling because it's only $2,000. I don't think he's calling because the card's coming. So I think either way.
But I mean, you got the extra bonus of an extra card coming. So
we do.
That's all I'm saying is it's probably going to end up being the same regardless of what we do here.
Yeah.
But my way gives us an extra opportunity to get a little bit more out. But it's very close. It's very close.
Yeah. Okay, well, I'm still just calling.
All right, well, I'm still raising.
Okay. So it should be.
All right, so here it says, this was a blank and a bad card to raise. What was I representing? King 10, King 9. I'd picked up a flush draw with my second pair. I thought that I was still ahead of his range, putting him on 4, 4, 5, 5, or maybe ace 4, ace 9. I decided to call with the plan to call the river if a blank hits. I really think you got to think about raising here at some point. Not now.
Yeah, I don't know about the, you know, I if he just bets $2,000 on the river, I might consider raising, but I don't know. If he checks the river, I would definitely bet.
Sure.
But, you know, again, if he has three kings and we're raising, we're only going to get called by a better hand, really, unless he's just that stubborn and thinks $2,000 is nothing. So we're also talking about a min raise, too, not the real raise, which would be $6,000. So anyway, all right, so the river.
The river is the tray of spades. So our final board is King of Diamonds, King of Clubs, Ten of Spades, Deuce of Diamonds, Tray of Spades. Shouldn't change anything unless he has pocket trays, right? He says the villain thinks for a few seconds and counts out a bet of $4,000. Whoa!
Oh, we got that money that we wanted, didn't we? And we didn't have to raise him.
Which is actually perfect at this point because now that he's changed his bet, that's an alarm bell for me. Not that I feel like I'm behind, but I'm going to feel confident just calling behind, I think, and getting the $4,000 that I was planning to get out of a mini, all right, and not open the betting in case we're wrong.
Right. And by us just calling, he might be emboldened that he thought we missed a draw here. You know, I mean, obviously he's not a dunce because he's got 28,000. It's not like when he started the hand. So it's not like he can't put together, this guy might be drawing, you know. We could have missed a straight draw. We could have missed a flush draw on the turn, which we did. So if he's confident that we didn't have a king or a ten in our hand, then he's going to think his sevens or whatever are good because all undercards came the rest of the way and no draws got there. So that could be a reason why he's raising betting more this time. But I'm still just going to call. I can't raise here. I can't raise here. I mean, he could literally have any king and was just milking us all along and saw that we were coming along. And now he's hoping we have a 10 because he has a king, you know. So the fact that he increased his bet means that he's confident. And if he's confident, then I'm just going to call and hope that it's something like sevens.
Right. Yeah. Okay. Well, here it says, I went into the tank and asked if he had a king, and he said he didn't have a king, but beat all no pair hands. Yeah. I played the whole hand back to my head and couldn't put him on having a hand beating my tens and kings with an eight, aside from maybe 9-10 suited or maybe jack 10. I had to call 4K to win 17,500, so I was getting 4.4 to 1. That, along with what he said, led me to believe I was ahead. I called, and he flipped over 4-4, announcing that my 8-3 of diamonds was no good, and I flipped over my 10-8 and took down the hand.
8-3 of diamonds? Well, what do you think you have 8-3 of diamonds?
Oh, ace-3.
Oh, ace-3. Well, that makes more sense. I was going to say, who would put you on 8-3 of diamonds?
Who would put you on ace-3 of diamonds either?
That's kind
of your diamond draw isn't good. You know, ace-3, that's pretty specific.
That is pretty specific, too, but 8-3 was, like, really off the wall. Why would he give that information that I beat all no-pair hands? That's so stupid. I mean, you still could be behind. It could be Jack 10. It could be...
We're going to fairly weak player, so, you know...
Yeah. Oh, man, that's horrible. But, yeah, it makes sense. 4-4, right?
You're going to figure out whether he's telling the truth or not. So that's why I think the table talk is hilarious. I mean, I saw that in a couple of the tournaments this week, and I'm like, you know, just shut up, guys.
Don't say anything.
You're not really getting anything out of this. You know, I know these people think they can talk people out of stuff, but, you know, just shut up. It's just that.
If we went back and thought about it, you know, his original line was the min raise meant deuces to sixes. And that's what he had. He had fours. So he could have had threes and boated on the end there, though. That's the thing. So that's why a call is in order there, not a raise.
Right, exactly. And playing my way, we would have lost 2,000, I think, probably on this. I mean, 2,000 of value, I mean. He probably would have called. I really do think he would have called on the on my turn raise, but I don't think he would have called the river at that point.
Yeah. Wow, interesting. All right. Well, you know, at least he gets something out of it. You know, I mean, and the fact that I wonder how he did in the tournament, too. Maybe we'll find out. Because that must have given him a decent amount, because that's another, 2-4. Six. So that was like another 10 grand in his stack, so that was pretty good. But
yeah, easily. Yeah, that's massive at that point. Now he's got 50 big blinds.
That's awesome. All right, well, always enjoy getting a hand from the Kiwis. And Scott, enjoy the rest of your time out there. Hope everything goes well. Take down another sword to win, and report back next week. I'm Chris Cosenza.
And I'm Scott Long.
We'll see you at the tables.
Annie Up is a production of AnnieUpMagazine.com and is recorded at WDAE 620 AM in Tampa. Contact us at podcast@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call our hotline at 813-448-1120. If you'd like to advertise, send us an email at advertising@AnnieUpMagazine.com or call 727-331-4335. Some music used in this episode comes courtesy of the PodSafe Music Network.